edition of The Spotlight from Mikko Vitale and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei describes the normalization of ties between some Muslim countries and Israel as one of the biggest acts of betrayal. Forces of the Israeli regime kill yet another Palestinian in the occupied territories. And a mine explosion in Turkey leaves nearly 30 people dead. Thank you for joining us. Iran's leader says the Muslim world can claim its rightful place in global geopolitics through unity and overcoming the temptations of enemies, especially the U.S. and Israel. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said to have unity, Muslims should work together to preserve their common interests and thwart the plots of arrogant powers. The leader also noted that the differences between the two major branches of Islam should not lead to disputes among Muslims. He said there are extremists among both Sunnis and Shias, but have nothing to do with either. The leader stressed that those who inflame the sentiments of one faith in the name of support for another should be seriously confronted. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, the enemies have been seeking to drive a wedge among Muslims by creating and empowering Israel. He warned that divergence among Muslim nations has paved the way for intensified crackdowns and atrocities against people in Palestine and other Islamic countries. The leader also described the normalization of ties between some Muslim countries and the Israeli regime as one of the biggest acts of betrayal. He stressed, however, that unity is still possible among Muslim nations through hard work and perseverance in the face of difficulties. Ayatollah Khamenei cited the example of the Islamic Republic of Iran, saying it stood up to former world powers, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, when it was a sapling. The leader said, now that the Islamic Republic has turned into a mighty tree, no one should even consider uprooting it. Ayatollah Khamenei was speaking at a meeting with the participants in the Islamic Unity Conference, which was held in Tehran in recent days. Masoud Shajari is with the Islamic Human Rights Commission. He says unity among Muslims is the only way to thwart U.S. plots. Have a listen.
It really is is now very clear for everyone to see that what has come in the last years as a result of policy of United States and the Western world, in not just in the region of Middle East, but everywhere else. I mean, look, it's very easy. Just look at Afghanistan, look at Iraq, look at Syria, look at Libya. You see that there is a destruction, total destruction of the civil society, destruction of the infrastructure, and what they have replaced it with is really chaotic and sort of an environment where it's not fit for ordinary human beings to live. And the solution is that the Muslims to come together. Muslims, in reality, are on receiving end of all these oppression, and they need to unite and they need to stand.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has decried the, quote, meddlesome remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron on the recent riots in the country. Nasser Kanani said Macron's condemnation of Iran's response to the violence encourages rioters and outlaws. The spokesman said the condemnation comes while the French government itself has threatened to forcibly break an oil refinery strike that began almost 3 weeks ago. Kanani stressed that the flagrant hypocrisy once again proves that many Western governments use human rights as a tool to achieve their political goals. Riots erupted in Iran after a young woman died days after collapsing at a police station. A forensic report has dismissed allegations that she was beaten up, saying she died due to an underlying medical condition. The Iranian foreign minister has criticized Western double standards in condemning Iran's response to the recent riots in the country. Hussein Amir Abdullahian says the EU never gives such a response to similar events in Western countries. He is urging European officials to adopt a realistic approach to the issue. Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell. The top Iranian diplomat added that the Islamic Republic enjoyed strong popular support and an efficient democracy. He stressed that Iran is not a land of velvet and color coups. In turn, Borrell assured Amir Abdullahian that the EU does not wish to interfere in Iran's internal affairs. Some EU officials have criticized Iran for its response to the unrest, threatening sanctions. Iran has warned of retaliatory measures in case of such a move. Rescuers are racing against time to find dozens of people trapped after a coal mine blast in northern Turkey. 28 people have already been confirmed dead in the Friday tragedy. A local governor says a team of rescuers have managed to reach a point in the pit some 250 meters below ground. But it's not clear yet if they would be able to go any closer to the trapped workers. 11 miners have so far been pulled out alive. Nearly 50 others remain trapped. A total of 110 miners were working when the methane blast occurred in the town of Amasra. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is set to fly to the scene. It was the deadliest industrial accident in years in Turkey. The worst mine disaster there occurred in 2014, when more than 300 people died in the western town of Soma. Now moving on to tensions between Russia and the West, where a war of words is now escalating over Ukraine. President Vladimir Putin has warned of global consequences of any NATO military offensives against his forces.
In any case, direct contact, direct clash of NATO troops with the Russian army is a very dangerous move, which could lead to a global catastrophe. I hope that those who are saying this are smart enough not to take such a step.
Putin was addressing a news conference in Kazakhstan. On Thursday, EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell said the Russian army would be annihilated if Putin launches a nuclear attack against Ukraine. NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg also said Russia would face severe consequences if it uses a nuclear weapon against Ukraine. Russia has said it will use nuclear weapons if its security, including that of the newly annexed regions of Ukraine, is threatened. While Ukraine has made recent gains in the country's Kherson region and the northern part of Donbass, there have been disturbing reports of reprisals against the so-called pro-Russia collaborators. Our correspondent in Donbass investigates.
The battered town of Obeznoy. I came here to find out if locals are fearful of the Ukrainian army, who have made recent gains not far to the west. A local school in the center of town.
Yes, we are worried. If the Ukrainian army comes here, there will be reprisal against teachers. But our strength is in the hope that it will never happen. I have colleagues whose children happen to be on the other side. They are afraid of coming to work because they are scared for their children and themselves.
Why do you think Ukraine would kill teachers? What's the reasoning behind that?
They say that we are ideological frontline workers and we are involved in Russian propaganda. This is the main thing that teachers are blamed for, but this region is 80% Russian speakers.
Irina, who's lived in this town all her life, tells me that she has heard rumors that teachers have been killed in Kupiansk, a town recently taken by Ukraine. This shocking video was posted online, claiming to be civilians in Kupiansk. It was uploaded by Maxim Zorin, a former member of Ukraine's notorious Azov Regiment, although he later altered his post, claiming the video had been taken from a Russian soldier's phone.
Now, to my knowledge, this is the only video that has surfaced in this war so far that clearly shows civilians being executed and dumped into a mass grave. Now, this video has been completely ignored by the mainstream media of NATO countries. Why? Because the evidence suggests a strong likelihood that these are Ukrainian soldiers executing pro-Russian civilians.
A headline from Britain's Daily Mail newspaper. The article quotes an advisor to Ukraine's Interior Ministry. A hunt has been declared on collaborators, and their life is not protected by law. Our intelligence services are eliminating them, shooting them like pigs. A humanitarian center. The Ukrainian government have not only threatened teachers, but those who distribute or receive humanitarian aid with jail.
We did nothing bad. We tried to help children and elderly people. What did we do? We were giving out aid under shelling. We helped people who couldn't walk. What shall we be afraid of? We just helped. I think there's nothing bad in it.
One of the volunteers asks us for a lift to help an old woman nearby.
What do you think of the Ukrainians threatening people who take humanitarian aid?
We heard of it. We even saw a video that in Kupiansk, some guys were taken into trenches and shot in the head. We have no internet, no proof. But they say there are nationalistic battalions that do it. It shouldn't be so. We are all people, Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian.
While thousands of pro-Russians flee Ukrainian advances in fear, those that remain in areas taken over by Ukraine risk execution due to their political leanings. Indeed, most in Donbass expect a genocide or ethnic cleansing of Russian speakers if the Ukrainians were to ever reconquer the region. Zhonimir Rebeznoy, Donbass.
Britain's Prime Minister has appointed Jeremy Hunt as the new Chancellor. He will replace Kwasi Kwarteng, who was sacked amid market chaos sparked by the government's controversial economic growth package.
I met the former Chancellor earlier today. I was incredibly sorry to lose him. He is a great friend, and he shares my vision to set this country on the path to growth. Today, I have asked Jeremy Hunt to become the new Chancellor. He's one of the most experienced and widely respected government ministers and parliamentarians, and he shares my convictions and ambitions for our country. He will deliver the medium-term fiscal plan at the end of this month. He will see through the support.
In a U-turn, the Prime Minister also announced the scrapping of plans to cut taxes for corporations. Truss admitted that financial markets could not keep up with government spending. Truss added that her government would slow state spending to reduce debt. Truss's proposed growth package left her own party members openly doubting her policies, with some politicians calling for her ouster.
You know, I think the only decent thing that Tory backbenchers could do now is call time on Liz Truss and this entire UK government and allow people across the UK to have a general election. I mean, this is beyond a joke. It was never funny, but Liz Truss has already, through her own decisions, crashed the economy and heaped misery on people who were already struggling with a cost of living crisis. Now, today, she has forced her Chancellor to carry the can for her decisions. So she had already shown herself to be completely out of her depth as Prime Minister. As of today, she is also a lame duck Prime Minister. The sooner she goes and the sooner people get the chance to get rid of this Tory government that is doing so much damage once and for all, the better.
Last month, Truss introduced key fiscal policy pledges that were laid out in ex-Chancellor Quarting's so-called mini-budget plan. Quarting was under pressure to reverse his fiscal plan after it shook markets and prompted a backlash among politicians. In an effort to appease her opponents, Truss asked Quarting to step aside as Chancellor. Among the financial pledges were vast amounts of unfunded tax cuts. These were meant to be financed through borrowing billions in bonds. Britain has been reeling from high inflation, a cost of living crisis, and soaring energy prices. U.S. President Joe Biden has delivered his national security strategy. He has again pointed to China as the biggest threat to U.S. security and the world order. That being the case, the question would be, why does the U.S. take a militaristic approach to contain China, threatening global peace and stability in the process?
The rising rivalries between the U.S. and China are set to dominate the coming years in the 21st century. That is because the U.S. has unveiled its long-delayed national security strategy, where China is named as the most consequential geopolitical challenge for the regime in Washington. That means that Washington is prioritizing winning over China, as Beijing is seen as the only global rival to the U.S. Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, said, "The People's Republic of China harbors the intention and increasingly the capacity to reshape the international order in favor of one that tilts the global playing field to its benefit." The U.S. strategy further insists that China represents the most consequential challenge to the global order. It also says the U.S. must win the economic arms race with the superpower if it hopes to retain its global influence. The strategy has warned that China's rapid advances in technology is aimed at molding the world order. The strategy is in line with the rhetoric pursued by the Biden administration and its predecessor. Biden officials have accused Russia and China of looking to change the so-called rules-based order.
When it comes to the U.S.-China relationship, the two have clashed on a variety of issues, but most, if not all, have been initiated by Washington. The two countries have faced off over trade, Beijing's claims to the South China Sea, Taiwan, and technology, and the U.S. has made it clear that it will not let China succeed in any of those areas.
The term has come to be seen as a synonym for Washington-led world order. The Biden administration has entangled itself in a number of global crises, including the war in Ukraine. The Washington regime encouraged the war in Ukraine by sending more weapons into the conflict zone. Washington is using the crisis to contain Russia. And by encouraging its allies to sever their energy ties with Moscow, Washington is trying to push European countries into its own sphere of influence. Furthermore, Washington is stoking tensions in the East Asia region by strengthening its ties with the Chinese Taipei. Back in August 2022, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, drawing an angry reaction from China. Beijing has warned that it will not tolerate Washington's meddlesome interference in its own affairs. But Washington's increasingly belligerent behavior in Europe and East Asia has pushed Russia and China closer together. They have forged closer ties in a variety of fields, including energy, business, and defense areas. Furthermore, both Moscow and Beijing are key members of the BRICS groups of countries and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Two bodies are playing key roles in shifting the Western-led balance toward a multipolar world. Russia and China have also forged closer ties with countries like Iran and India, which are emerging powers in the shifting geostrategic relations worldwide. It is now widely believed that Washington's ambitions to still lead the world is facing tough challenges. It appears that the regime in Washington has no longer the capability that it once possessed to dictate its hegemony.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me, in full, in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
The United States is not what you see in the flamboyant Hollywood movies. Normal life in the US might surprise you, as the number of people without a stable place to call home has increased by at least 22,500 over the past 3 years to 173,800 since the pandemic. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites. Stay tuned, please. The Hill wrote, "The typical American experiencing homelessness is often conceived of a mentally ill individual living in the subways of New York or an addict on the streets of San Francisco or Philadelphia. Those conceptions capture some of the crisis of homelessness, but not all of it. Among the 550,000 to 600,000 people experiencing homelessness in the U.S. are tens of thousands who are not chronically homeless, nor incapacitated due to illness or substance use disorder. These people are capable of work and ready to integrate into the mainstream job market. They are frequently overlooked in the debate on how we solve homelessness and also in publicly funded policy solutions." Works Fund combines paid work in social enterprise with transitional housing and support services for people not currently eligible for Housing First resources yet who are not self-resolving off the streets or out of shelters. Work programs act as a bridge for marginalized homeless populations with the capacity and desire to work to re-enter the workforce and obtain permanent housing. Tens of thousands of Americans fit that description. Solutions like Work benefit not only their target population, but also the larger community through earnings, cost savings, increased labor hours, and more available housing. The three-pronged approach of the Work model provides primary and secondary benefits, while its philosophy and implementation design allow for community integration and buy-in in a way that other strategies cannot. There has never been more urgency for employment-based solutions because of the ongoing labor shortage. The roughly 11 million jobs now unfilled represent a historic opportunity to increase employment among the homeless population. Employers are struggling to find workers, while over 70% of people experiencing homelessness are unemployed. And even those who are technically working are really underemployed. With more public support, work programs can develop relationships between local employers and municipal governments. Hill continued, "Homelessness is a symptom of many systematic failures of policy and practice in housing, behavioral health, workforce development, and the criminal justice system. There is no one-size-fits-all solution. It's past time to encourage innovation to develop programs that take into account the diversity of needs of people experiencing homelessness and promote the belief that those on the streets can and should be seen as assets to the community, as contributing members of society. Today, with homelessness on the rise in the U.S., U.S. citizens are perplexed by the lack of success their communities are having to adequately address this crisis." Also, Politico wrote, "Rising homelessness is tearing California cities apart. A crew of state workers arrived early one hot summer day to clear dozens of people camped under a dusty overpass near California's capital. The camp's residents gathered their tents, coolers, and furniture and shifted less than 100 feet across the street to city-owned land where they have been ever since. But maybe not for much longer. The city of Sacramento is taking a harder line on homeless encampments and is expected to start enforcing a new ban on public camping by the end of the month, if the courts allow." Also, Times of San Diego wrote, the first statewide snapshot of California's homelessness crisis since the pandemic hit reveals that the number of people without a stable place to call home increased by at least 22,500 over the past 3 years to 173,800. That's based on a Call Masters analysis of the federal government's point-in-time count, a biennial head count of people sleeping on the streets and in shelters tallied in by California cities and counties earlier this year for the first time since 2019. Homelessness experts mostly attribute the rise to precipitous drops in earnings during the pandemic among Californians already teetering on the edge. They also point to a worsening housing affordability crisis that is decades in the making. We have to solve this rotting core in the center of California, which is that we are a million units short of housing for exemplary low-income workers, said Margot Cochell, director of the UCSF Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative. While homelessness grew by 15%, roughly the same space as in recent years, something experts credit to pandemic-era safety nets like rental assistance, eviction moratoria, and stimulus checks. The data also indicates the problem has gotten worse for the state's Latino population. Critics are quick to point out the state is spending more than $14 billion on homelessness, but advocates say its response is just now beginning. The price tag is bigger now, said Tomika Moss, founder and chief executive of All Home, a San Francisco-based homeless policy organization, saying, meanwhile, the inflow is killing us. The numbers show the state's investment in shelters is bearing fruit. California created more than 14,000 shelter beds between 2019 and 2021. And local organizations reported this year the number of people staying in emergency and longer stay shelters ballooned by nearly the same amount, from 42,800 to 57,200 people, a 33% increase since 2019. Christopher Ware, president of the Center for Homeless Inquiry, said, most people, most politicians, when they talk about homelessness, it's we're going to build X number of shelters. It's shelter, shelter, shelter. Well, all of this construction of shelters doesn't really change the scope of the problem. Meanwhile, the unsheltered count or the number of people staying in tents, tarps, cars, and other spaces unfit for human habitation grew by 7% between 2019 and 2022 to 116,600 people. That's a bomb, but perhaps not reflective of the growing palpability of the crisis that dominates local headlines, political debates, and neighborhood discussions.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
hungry humans. Part 1.
This is the battlefield, a manifestation of humans' cruelty. Everything happens fast and in a riotous way in the battlefield. But sometimes wars are silent and hidden with an attractive and charming look. Such wars are sometimes more threatening and result in more victims. Like the war that I want to tell you about. A war that you may not have even imagined, but we are in the middle of the battlefield. I want to start my story with a question. Why is fast food so popular in this era? One recipe and one taste. Everything is similar. Ready-to-eat foods are without stories because there is no time to tell stories in the middle of the battlefield. We can find them in these hypermarkets. There is no story here. The story of each product is summarized in barcodes and a few lines and numbers below them. It doesn't matter where the food comes from. They say here instead of everywhere. Here, like on the battlefield, everything happens fast. Undoubtedly, every food has a story, even if we don't have time to hear it. Foods sometimes make up their own stories, which are sometimes scary and bitter. The scary story of Zahak started from the kitchen. Foods have their own stories and make up other stories, like potatoes. The potato. How the Humble Spud Rescued the Western World is the name of a book by Larry Zuckerman. It is about the potato and its relationship with the Industrial Revolution. Who would believe that potatoes played a key role in one of the biggest events in human history? I asked Larry Zuckerman how potatoes suddenly became a widespread food in the world.
So I would not say that it caused the Industrial Revolution, but I would go so far as to say that in England, it helped make the Industrial Revolution possible because it sustained the people who were doing the industry. When factory workers got off shift, the last thing they really wanted to do was cook. And right outside the factory gates were people who had set up carts with ovens, and they would bake the potatoes. And they would sell them for cheap, and people would have a hot baked potato coming right off the factory floor, a nice instant treat. And that was, in a sense, the beginning of modern street food. So the pace of life began to increase. I think the industrialization happened first, and the potato became necessary for it to continue or made it easier.
Larry, what was the main issue, the key issue that made potato one of the widespread food in that era? Were the factories or industrialization the main reason?
There's a point about the world moving faster. So it's not just that people moved to factories, it's that life itself was speeding up tremendously, that there were fewer holidays even, that there was less time in the day to do things, that cooking, you wanted something that was fast. Potatoes raised. It saved time, it saved labor. So that's the way that I think of the potato being as a labor-saving device. That's the way that the potato helped the age of fast food. Today, I mean, it's like, there's no time for anything.
The potato story was about pace. Life had become too fast. In that era, people were in a hurry for everything. Street food was a new way to save time. Street foods are prepared in the shortest time and can be eaten anywhere. Then there was enough time for people to do more important things than cooking and eating. In those days, people tried to spend their time to produce more products. After many years doing the same thing, people realized that they were producing much more goods than they needed. People had to consume more goods because production was increasing. Otherwise, there would be no production. In this way, humans enter the era of mass consumption. Mass production and consumption meant that previous methods had to be changed. For example, the chicken meat and beef consumed by humans were obtained from farms in the past, but in that era, the farms could not supply this amount of meat anymore. So industrial livestock production came into existence. Animal husbandry describes how animals gain a lot of weight in a short time. For example, the weight that chickens gain in 6 weeks in today's industrial poultry farming is almost twice the weight that chicks gained in the same period of time 50 years ago in farms. This rapid growth of chicken in a short time and under unusual conditions inflicted a lot of pain on them in their short life, kind of pain that few people have heard about. Earlier I said that foods in the new supermarkets do not have a story, but it is better to say that they have a story, but it is not written anywhere. Peter Singer. He's one of the greatest philosophers in the world. He wrote a book on the story of pain. In his book, Animal Liberation, he talks about the great pain that industrial animal production inflicts on animals. This is the last chapter of the short life of industrial chickens. Asked Peter Singer what made a philosopher like him write a book about the short and painful life of these animals.
Well, I am primarily concerned about the suffering we inflict on animals. I think we should not do that as an ethical imperative. I think in the way we treat animals, especially in factory farms, it is indisputable. So many people, when they think about animals being farmed, they think of animals outside grazing in the fields. But unfortunately, over the past 50 years, in many countries, animals, or most animals, are no longer in the fields.
Can you give us a talk about the suffering imposed, for example, to hens in factory farming?
In some cases, the confinement is very tight. An example of that would be for hens who are laying eggs. So the standard industrial cage, and that's not just for one hen, that might be for four or five hens. So each hen in this cage has just a very small amount of space. They're very crowded together and they can't even stretch their wings. In fact, some of the cages are so small that even one bird in the cage could not stretch her wings fully. And instead of there being one bird, there are four or five birds. Now, as well as the crowding, inability to move freely or stretch limbs, there is also a high level of aggression. When you put hens so close to each other that they can't escape, then the more aggressive birds can attack the weaker birds. And in order to prevent the more aggressive birds from actually killing the weaker birds, they cut off the sharp point of the beak. But the operation of cutting off the end of the beak is itself a very painful operation. Also, the chickens are raised for meat, not in cages, but they are extremely crowded. Maybe 20,000 birds in a single shed. In terms of the amount of space that each bird has, it's roughly one sheet of paper. So it's roughly that much space that a meat chicken has. And the crowding causes a lot of stress. Also, the birds bred to grow very quickly. What that means is that the birds are very young and their leg bones are not mature, but they're eating all the time and they're putting on a lot of weight. For many of the birds, actually, it's painful simply to stand up because their leg bones are so weak that they bend under the weight, and in some cases, actually, the legs collapse. And if the legs collapse, the birds just die because they can no longer move, they can no longer get to food or water.
Mass and high-speed production of food was not possible without the help of machines, so foods were produced by machines. Machines did not show mercy to animals either. It means that humans did not program the machines for such aim. Important that animals had souls, emotions, and feelings. From then on, animals were just goods that had to be reproduced, sold, and consumed rapidly. Whatever Peter Singer explained about the industrial animal production in chickens' case fits about cows and calves and industrial cattle farming too. It refers to raising a large number of cows in very large dairy farms with conditions that were unimaginable before this era. In these farms, cows have to eat more to grow faster. Fast production of meat and milk should be done in any possible way. There had to be changes in the stomach or the feeding method of cows so that they could eat more and more. Mm-hmm.
cows couldn't grow as fast as possible by eating natural fodder, considering the amount of market demand. So farmers had to look for other materials for cow feed. So corn became a key element in the cow's growth. This large amount of corn had to be produced so that they could eat and grow faster. The new issue was the mass production of corn. This amount of corn should have been produced in the shortest time. Statistics of the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations show the world production of corn increased sevenfold between 1995 and 2005. This rapid growth was achieved at the cost of the destruction of a large part of the Amazon forest and other arable lands of this planet. According to statistics, 67% of the world's agricultural lands have been infertile. The cruel cycle of industrial meat production does not spare even oil, and they use a large amount of this fossil fuel for tractors and food delivery trucks. According to the statistics, it takes 5 barrels of oil to grow a beef cattle. Numbers show for every 120 grams of beef, 7.5 square meters of fertile forests are destroyed, and as a result, 240 kilograms of carbon dioxide are released. More and faster production of food causes a lot of suffering for animals and also causes a lot of damage to nature.
Limelight. India, Singapore, and the Philippines are among those building new labs certified as biosafety level 3 or above. But some researchers worry about the cost and risks. In this regard, we have provided an exclusive article published in Nature. Stay tuned, please. In the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, plans are afoot to build more than 40 high-level biosafety labs around the world, including in India, the Philippines, and Singapore. Investments in biosafety labs often follow major epidemics, but some researchers are concerned about the growing number of facilities that will handle some of the world's most dangerous pathogens. Some scientists worry about the huge cost of maintaining biosafety level 3 and BSL-4 facilities, whereas others fear the risks posed by these labs, such as the possibility of creating pathogens that are more dangerous or of microorganisms escaping. But researchers in the countries that plan to build these labs say they are needed. The lack of high security labs in some regions became particularly apparent during the pandemic because work on the live virus that causes COVID-19 SARS-CoV-2 must be done at a BSL-3 or BSL-4 facility. The pandemic exposed the weakness of health systems worldwide in recognizing and responding to emerging threats in public health, said Bharati Pawar, India's Minister for Health and Family Welfare, at a ceremony to mark the start of construction of one of the nation's new BSL-3 labs in Bengaluru last month. India's plans are among the most ambitious. The country is in the process of building 5 BSL-3 facilities and is planning at least another 9 more. 4 institutions have also said they will construct BSL-4 labs with the highest level of containment too. India currently only has one such facility that is operational, and the government has committed to building 4 new national institutes of virology, 2 of which will also eventually handle BSL-4 pathogens. BSL-3 labs are designed so that scientists can safely work with potentially lethal and inhalable pathogens in a contained environment. Experiments are conducted in sealed workspaces in which the air is filtered and not recirculated, and the entrance to the facility is typically secured by self-closing doors. BSL-4 facilities in which researchers work with fatal pathogens that can spread through aerosols and for which vaccines or treatments are lacking or limited require extra security measures. These labs are isolated from other sections of a building and have a dedicated air supply, and researchers change clothes and shower before entering and leaving the premises. The pandemic has raised public awareness of emerging diseases and the need for labs, creating a favorable environment for these investments, says Pragaya Yadav, a virologist who heads the BSL-4 facility at the National Institute of Virology in Pune. A country India's size needs more high containment facilities, she says. Elsewhere in Asia, Kazakhstan, Singapore, and the Philippines have announced plans to build their first BSL-4 facilities. Beyond the region, the United States has committed to adding another BSL-4 lab to its existing group of about a dozen maximum containment facilities. And Russia announced last year that it will build 15 BSL-4 labs. Since the COVID-19 pandemic began, plans to build 27 BSL-4 labs have been announced worldwide, say Gregory Koblenz, a biodefense researcher at George Mason University in Arlington, Virginia, and Philippa Lensos, a biosecurity researcher at King College London, who have tracked the number and distribution of BSL-4 facilities globally. But some researchers question the need for so many extra BSL-3 and BSL-4 labs and note the hefty cost of maintaining them. Ilich Mombo, a virologist at the International Center for Medical Research of France Weill in Gabon, says that roughly 10% of his lab's budget goes on experiments, whereas around 90% is spent on checking, maintaining, and repairing the facility. When instruments break, they cost a lot to fix, and there are no trained technicians in the region. Researchers are sometimes sent to work elsewhere, says Mombo. Thomas Kiazik, a virologist who heads the high contaminant operation at the Galveston National Lab in Texas, a BSL-4 facility, says that his team's lab receives close to $12 million a year from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases just for maintenance and operations. some $2 million of which is spent on 24-hour security, and about $2 million is required to power the ventilation, heating, and air conditioning, as well as to operate the BSL-3 portion of the lab. Rohani Navarro, a vet at Philippines National Institute of Molecular Biology and Biotechnology in Manila, says she and her colleagues are constantly writing grant applications just to maintain their BSL-3 operations. She says the annual certification, which involves a thorough safety review, costs some $40,000. High contaminant facilities can become like a white elephant that isn't used. Some researchers also worry that having more of these labs will increase the risks associated with them, including of workers being infected. Scientists say labs often struggle to find well-trained staff to run high containment facilities. Kim Sells, who researches health policy and health systems at the nonprofit organization Alliance for Improving Health Outcomes in Manila, says in a survey of lab practices in the Philippines, found that biosafety officers had only a weak understanding of biosafety. More labs could also lead to more high-risk research, such as gain-of-function studies, in which pathogens are sometimes modified, which could make them more dangerous to people. A large body of evidence suggests that SARS-CoV-2 jumped to humans from wild animals, probably at a live animal market. But some scientists say they cannot exclude the